everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our in-depth, original, investigative reporting white paper, Saving the Planet, Saving Ourselves. Part 4. 2 decades ago, when I started reporting and giving commentaries about global warming's future threats, climatologists put their attention on certain landmark events, commonly known as tipping points, which would dramatically disrupt the equilibrium of the Earth's ecological and atmospheric systems. These tipping points, often listed as 12 in number, are limited to singular changes in the Earth's geological and oceanic conditions that would accelerate global warming, such as the melting of the ice fields in the Arctic or Greenland or Antarctica, and the loss of mountain glaciers, and the thawing of the northern permafrost and tundra in Russia and Canada and Alaska, and disruption of the Indian and West African monsoon seasons, and desertification, and loss of tropical rainforests, especially the Amazon and Papua New Guinea, and many others. Or recently, the probable loss of the planet's largest bioarea, one of the great wonders of the natural world, the boreal forest, which spans the northern hemisphere from North America and Siberia and northern Europe, has been added as another tipping point. And according to an article published in 2007 issue of Cryosphere, the melting of the Arctic summer ice has already passed its threshold. Today, the larger picture of climate change has replaced the more compartmentalized view of global warming, which is now understood as one phenomena in the larger picture of climate change. The rapid changes in the global climate include many destructive and environmental elements in addition to the warming of the Earth and our atmosphere. For many years, I have hosted programs that address the major 12 tipping points agreed upon by the vast majority of the international climatology and geological scientific communities. However, the tipping points are more or less milestone events, and they only provide a small sliver view of the problem. Unto themselves, they inadequately explain the deeper underlying dynamics and interrelationships with other forces that will bring forth the catastrophic conditions so often associated with climate change and global warming. To better understand the powerful forces at work on the Earth, and gaining a greater appreciation for various dominant feedback loops is more instructive. Therefore, I will only list the 12 tipping points and then later proceed into deeper explanations of the more important and worrisome feedback mechanisms now underway. And why? Why is this important? Why should you care? The vast majority of people listening right now are probably not listening from one of the tipping point areas. If you get up in the morning, you turn on your water faucet, you can take a shower. And depending upon how large your hot water tank is, well, that's how long the hot water shower can be. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, or 20. When you go out to water your lawn, you have water to do so. You go to a grocery store, outdoor market, there's a bountiful amount of food from not only the United States, but around the world, Chile and South Africa. Even the Canary Islands provide us with items that we consume on a daily basis. When you turn on the thermostat, you can cool a hot room down or turn it a different direction and warm it up. You don't have to worry about starving to death if you're the average American, nor do you have to worry, depending upon where you live and the season of the year, about being inundated with an excessive force of rain or a tornado, a hurricane, an earthquake, a volcanic eruption. And as a result, we put these things out of our mind. We don't think about the salinity or the acidity of the coral reefs or the ocean. We use our plastic and throw it away. It doesn't come to our mind, well, is that ending up in the Pacific Ocean? Is it inundating the shores of Hawaii? The answer is yes, it is. 20,000 pieces of plastic on just one shore on one island in the Big Island of Hawaii. It's become a garbage dump site now. So it will impact people depending upon where you live. If you are in Puerto Rico during a hurricane that we just had, or in Florida, or in Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, you're going to know about global warming. If you're in a tornado belt area in Oklahoma or in southern Texas, you also know about it. If you're in Southern California, anywhere in California or Oregon, Montana, you'll know about fires. In fact, thousands of people have lost their homes just in the last year alone. So it depends upon where you live. Your sense of knowing this, is it an intentional neglect, or are you intentionally learning about the world you live in? When you go to a restaurant, you can have fish. Now, it will probably be farm-raised tilapia or farm-raised shrimp or farm-raised salmon, but do you really care? Are you aware of the growing conditions of that fish? What happened to the wild fish? What if I told you that 90% of all large fish are gone? You go to the internet, you can see almost any animal in the world, some in their natural habitats, others in confined areas or sanctuaries. But what if I told you that between 150 and 200 species are dying every 24 hours of plants and animals and insects? In fact, so many insects are dying that it's affecting their food origination with birds. And the ice is thinning in the glacial areas, and especially around the Arctic, and as a result, we now see on the internet a viral photograph of a starving-to-death polar bear, something that we wouldn't think we would see, but it's there. So we must keep in context that, yes, we might feel comfort, safety at this moment, so it's irrelevant what's happening with the environment. How many people really care? Now, if you ask someone, do you care about the planet? They'll say, yes. Then ask them, what are you doing to ensure its safety of humans and species? And then they give you that kind of distant stare of realizing that it wasn't a trick question. It wasn't a gotcha question. It was simply communicating with people who are disconnected more often than not. So what I'm doing now is just trying to reconnect you with how what is happening in California is happening because of our lifestyles, the industrial farming, what we've done to the planet. The planet's feedback loops are collapsing, and that will impact us. Let's take a look at the melting of the Arctic polar ice cap. The threshold for this tipping point has already been passed, and the conditions are accelerating towards an ice-free Arctic. Now, here's what's important. An ice and glacier-free Greenland is also undergoing change at this moment. It is estimated this may raise sea levels by 20 feet. And disintegration of the West Antarctic ice shelf. I remember when we were reading that the Larsen B shelf would not break off as the largest iceberg ever recorded breaking off for 100 to 150 years. 2 weeks later, it broke off. Now we had the Larsen C shelf, as large as the state of Delaware, break off, and it's splintered. So there's going to be a lot more calving and breaking off. So all mathematical models that this is not going to happen in your lifetime are wrong. It is happening. Ask the people in California whose homes have been burned. Ask the people in Houston that received trillions of gallons of water and flooded their homes and released toxins from the nearby refineries into the soil. And the land around them is polluted now, the air is polluted, and the water is polluted. It's real to them. Also, we're losing the Earth's glaciers, which will contribute to less albedo. We have a disruption in the Atlantic Ocean's conveyor belt from the Gulf Stream due to the entry of fresh water from the melting of the Arctic and Greenland. The permanent fixture of the warm ocean water phase in the central equatorial Pacific Ocean, better known as El Nino. We have disruption of Indian and Southeast Asian monsoon season and the disruption of West African monsoon in the Sahel system, the ecoclimate zone between the Sahara Desert and in the north and the Sudan and Savannah in the south. These are all happening now as we speak. And the melting of the permafrost and tundra under the northern Arctic climate and its release of vast quantities of methane greenhouse gases, commonly known as clathrate gun effects. The desertification or the expansion of deserts consuming semi-arid lands, the loss of the ozone layer above the Arctic, the loss of the rainforest, especially the Amazon and New Guinea. This also includes forest dieback due to droughts. More than 120 million trees died in the last year in California alone. That becomes tinder for the fires. The loss of the northern boreal forest reaching around northern climates of Canada, Siberia, and Scandinavia. So although these tipping points are critical benchmarks in the progress of ongoing climate change, in 2010, scientists started to observe and report more frequently about feedback loops. In 2011, two more loops were observed and four more in 2012. The number of feedback loops continues to increase, and over 60 have been identified so far. Now, feedback loops also help us to better understand the long-term consequences after tipping points are reached. There is considerable overlap between many of these feedback mechanisms, and many work in conjunction with each other, thereby intensifying the atmospheric and geological changes taking place. Climatologists have observed two opposing kinds of feedback loops, positive and negative feedbacks. Positive feedback, which concerns us the most, is when a system is placed under extreme stress. It affects another force, which in turn intensifies and pushes the momentum of the initial system. Consequently, that system accelerates in the direction it is being forced towards. A positive feedback, therefore, forces an increase in net temperature change. The common and obvious example is the melting Arctic. As the ice melts, there is less white surface to reflect the sun's solar radiation back into space. This is referred to as the loss of albedo. The ocean gets darker and absorbs more heat because the ice is not there to reflect it, and further warms the ocean, hence accelerating further ice thinning and shrinkage. This is an especially rapid feedback mechanism called the Charney loop. The increase of water vapor, another greenhouse gas, being released into the atmosphere as the days get hotter is another Charney feedback. We also find feedback loops operating in our bodies. Take blood clotting as one example. When a blood vessel is damaged, such as from a bruise or our platelets immediately gather at the site of the vessel's injury. A series of chemical processes is activated that enable the platelets to adhere to the wound while simultaneously attracting more platelets together until a clot is formed. Well, negative feedback loops, which are favorable for the Earth to maintain its homeostasis, offset net temperature increase. Unfortunately, there are far less negative feedback than positive loops, and many of these remain theoretical, such as black body radiation in an ice-free ocean that might release thermal radiation away from the Earth. Well, using the melting Arctic ice again as an example, there's another theory that a dark Arctic ocean may directly absorb more CO2 into its waters, increasing desertification, and also presents another negative feedback. A desert, like the ice sheets, reflects the sun's heat back into space. As more land turns into desert in parts of Africa and West China and Central Asia and elsewhere, larger land masses will produce an albedo effect to offset the Earth's rising temperature. Unfortunately, our growing deserts and high-altitude winds traveling across the oceans pose serious warming problems as well. Nevertheless, when all the positive and negative feedback loops are weighed in a scale for comparison, the latter will certainly not reset global warming trends. Negative feedback may slow global warming rates. However, the net energy represented by all positive feedback is far greater than the little relief and comfort the positive feedback loops can cumulatively provide. Some negative feedback mechanisms are more important to understand than others. I'm going to share a little bit about these now. Let's take a look at the ice albedo feedback. Albedo, meaning whiteness in Latin, is a term to measure the amount of incident solar radiation, such as sunlight, reflected off the surface. Albedo is measured on a scale of 0, meaning pure black, to 1.0, a surface that reflects away all radiation striking it. Clean, freshly fallen snow is 0.9. The Antarctic ice sheets are approximately 0.8. And that's why they're very good. They reflect back the sun. If you own two automobiles in your driveway, one white and the other black, and both are baking in the sun, you'll find that the surface on the white vehicle feels less hot. Likewise, when you sit in your white car, you'll feel less hot than if you were to sit in your black car. After a large snowfall, when everything is covered in white, more sunlight is reflected back into space and thus further contributes to colder air. As the snow melts, grass and dirt reappear and the surface darkens. The albedo effect feedback loop has been known and worried about by climatologists for a very long time. As the polar ice sheets and glaciers and sea ice in regions covered with snow continue to disappear, they are replaced by darker surfaces. That is not good, thereby absorbing rather than reflecting solar heat, and more captured heat increases ice melting, and hence a larger swath of darker surface to absorb even more sunlight. A second feedback associated with the albedo effect is the increase in the ocean's volume contributing to rising global sea levels. With respect to land that has been covered in snow and ice, the loss of the albedo also engenders earth movements such as earthquakes and shifting of ice sheets. And this in turn disrupts the terrestrial structural support ice sheets and glaciers rest upon and advances their decline and eventual collapse. This last point is of great concern to Antarctic researchers who monitor one of the largest ice sheets that rest on ground below sea level and is particularly susceptible to dramatic earth movements in the future as the ice gets thinner. A professor, Peter Wadharns, at the Scott Polar Institute at Cambridge University, has spent his entire career studying the Arctic. He was the first scientist to show that the northern polar ice cap was shrinking. According to him, he had an opportunity to speak with a couple of occasions, and he said that the Arctic will certainly be ice-free, and he didn't say a long time from now. He said its central basin before the end of this decade. Wow. That's in less than 10 years. And during a 2016 interview with the British Guardian newspaper, he explained that, quote, sea ice reflects about 50% of the solar radiation it receives back into space. By contrast, water reflects less than 10%. So if you replace ice with water, which is darker, much more solar heat will be absorbed by the ocean and the planet will heat up even more rapidly than it's doing at present. And as an example of this, of all the climatologists and environmental experts I have spoken with in preparation for this report, about 14 of them have stated that we could experience some cataclysmic shifts in our warming trend when the Arctic is ice-free. About 3 years post-Arctic free ice, we will start to see the heat bound up beyond anything we've experienced in human life, and it will cause desertification, droughts, massive amounts of die-off of plants, increasing in fire, and the release of methane gases unparalleled in human history. So when I ask, okay, give me a timeline, we realize it's subjective, that it's an opinion. And they said, if we told you what we really believe is happening, it would terrify people. And it would be immediately denounced because psychologically, economically, politically, we're not ready for the truth, not the full truth. And so most climatologists know the truth. They've studied the same literature we have, they said, but they want to be diplomatic. They don't want to put people into an end-of-time scenario. So they say, well, it'll be in 100, 1,000 years. No, he said, they said, in about anywhere from 10 to 13 years, you will start to see much of the world become non-sustainable, massive migrations, sea level rising to where at least 170 million people on the planet will not be able to call home home. Bangkok, London, New York, major cities, Washington, D.C., Miami, these cities will be underwater, and cities around the world that are on the coast and countries like Bangladesh will be substantially impacted in a negative way. And we will not do anything about it, they fear, until the day it actually happens, and then it's too late. So it's important you understand that I'm not giving a terrible prediction. I'm merely letting you know that the people who are the experts that really know this and who are not being politically correct, who are just telling the truth, are in alignment with the world's best expert on the Arctic melting. And he said to the Guardian, 10 years. So that's that's assuming that there's nothing that speeds that up or slows it down. So Greenland is also rapidly darkening. Although it is natural for ice melt during the warmer seasons, this loss is compensated for during the winter months when there is greater snowfall and freezing temperatures. However, any annual net loss of albedo is a disaster and a very important reason for concern. This loss is also happening across all the world's highest mountain ranges and peaks. There are over 5,500 glaciers in the Himalayan mountains and also of the Hindu Kush, which includes Mount Everest. Over 1 billion people depend upon the river waters issuing from these glaciers. And these glaciers reflect much of the sun's radiation back into the space. Yet according to the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development in Nepal, all of the Himalayan ranges, albedo, may be gone in the future. And as I mentioned earlier in this discussion, climatologists have believed that Antarctica and the eastern Antarctic shelf in particular will be the last place on the planet to experience anthropogenic climate change. However, this scenario has had to be reevaluated in recent years. Summer ice is now melting 1,000% faster during the past 50 years. Already, as explained earlier, the Western Antarctic sheet is becoming progressively less stable. A 2015 paper jointly researched by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute and the Utrecht University in the Netherlands suggests that the entire Antarctic continent could be unstable by centuries end. But that doesn't mean that we wait 100 years and then something happens. It means it'll be accelerating. And as it accelerates until it becomes unstoppable, we'll be experiencing that, and as we already are. At one time, there were many glaciers on the high range peaks in Africa. Today, only a few remain on Mount Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya, and also the Rwenzori, the range on the Congo-Uganda border. America's glaciers are also disappearing rapidly. At the end of the 19th century, there were 150 counted glaciers in Glacier National Park in Montana. As of 2017, only 26 of the remaining 39 can scientifically be considered as actual glaciers. That's how much has melted. The same is occurring throughout the remaining glacier peaks in Mexico, the Sierra Madres of Colombia and the Andes, and across Europe and elsewhere. Now we have to look at extreme storms. When a Category 4 or 5 hurricane hits land, we are fully aware of the devastation left in its wake. Hourly, we observe images of flooding, collapsed roofs on homes, snapped trees and poles on the news and weather channels. What we do now is we do not look for the invisible feedback loop, but it is there. It is one of the mechanisms of greenhouse gas release from these storms. Large hurricanes and typhoons create an updraft that carries moisture as far as the stratosphere, which begins between 8 to 12 miles above the Earth's surface, higher along the equator. And not only does this reduce the oxygen layer, which resides in the lower stratosphere, but it also carries water vapor into this higher atmospheric zone that otherwise has very little. The largest percentage of greenhouse gases emissions released into the atmosphere reside in the troposphere, the layer immediately above our heads. Now, there were a record number of devastating hurricanes in the Atlantic and Caribbean during the 2017 storm season. Hurricane Irma, which pummeled Puerto Rico into darkness, was the strongest tropical storm in the Caribbean on record. Hurricane Harvey leveled Houston with rising sea levels combined with unusually large rainfall. The capital of America's oil industry had more rain in a week than it usually gets in a year. 2 months later, tens of thousands of Houston residents remained homeless. Barely a single major network drew a correlation between these storms and anthropogenic climate change. Although the news portrayed the 2017 hurricane season as shocking and unusual, it is perfectly consistent with scientists' warnings about the planet's warming trends. Warmer ocean waters combined with rising winds and hotter air are the recipe for larger and more powerful storms. Ask whether we will experience a change in cyclone-like storms in the future. MIT's head of atmospheric science, Kerry Emanuel, stated, "We expect that Category 3, 4, and 5 storms will become more frequent globally as the climate warms. Per storm losses of life, well, and property losses will rise. So more humans, more animals, and more trees and shrubs and homes all destroyed." It's important for the listener to understand that no climate scientist will conclude that climate change is directly responsible for a hurricane. Hurricanes have occurred on the planet for millions of years. What scientists do agree on is that climate change exacerbates the intensity and strength of hurricanes and contributes to the moisture density for extreme precipitation. Now we're going to look at a wetter troposphere. When we think of global warming and fossil fuel emissions, in particular CO2, as the single most important culprits to be most worried about, we are only partially correct. Indeed, humanity's release of greenhouse gases such as CO2 and methane have passed their threshold and are now driving climate change. Nevertheless, the actual greenhouse effect is due to the predominance of water vapor being stored in the planet's troposphere due to the Earth's surface warming temperature. It is estimated that 60 to 70% of the planet's warming is associated with atmospheric water vapor. And because the other gases are non-condensable, they're more readily becoming packed into the atmosphere, whereas water vapor condenses and is released as precipitation, as rain. The increase of moisture entering the Earth's troposphere has been called the mother of all feedback loops. In 2014, climatologists at the Atmospheric Sciences Department at the University of Miami identified what they believe to be the largest feedback system that will amplify anthropogenic warming. Between 1979 and 2004, there has been a gradual moisturing of the upper atmosphere, and this increase can only be attributed to humanity's release of carbon dioxide. This has been the first study to finally confirm a direct relationship between human activity and the rise in water vapor into the upper troposphere above the Earth's surface. And this feedback mechanism is solely related to the way the sun's energy reaches the Earth, then reflected back and reabsorbed again by CO2 and water molecules, and finally emitted back to Earth again. So as the buildup of water vapor in the atmosphere thickens, it further heats the Earth's surface, hence accelerating more water evaporation into the upper troposphere. Our release of greenhouse gases exacerbates this feedback loop by trapping the reflected heat within the atmosphere. Consequently, heat energy gets reflected back into space. Scientists are now predicting that water vapor will be playing a far greater role in a rapidly heating planet in the years to come. Now let's examine methane release. Global warming's largest and most frightening ticking time bomb is the release of methane held frozen in the tundra and permafrost in the upper northern hemisphere. It is unfathomable to contemplate the full consequential weight of widespread permafrost melt. Ground-stored methane is the global warming bubble of our time. Unfortunately, the aftermath of bursting bubbles, including economic bubbles, are often far worse than anticipated. The global warming bubble, says environmentalist and columnist Robert Hunziker, is found in every remote corner of the planet, but it's most prominent in the Arabic area, where, and also in the Arctic area, where temperatures are increasing 200 to 300% faster than elsewhere on the planet. Hunziker reminds us that unlike the 2008 Wall Street financial collapse, money cannot fix this. A blowout of the climate change bubble cannot be bailed out. For a moment, consider the situation we now face and that we have been experiencing with record-breaking high temperatures, torrential storms and flooding, and widespread forest and grassland fires. The results are in. Human emission of greenhouse gases has contributed significantly to the severity of these climate events. At present, the Earth's atmosphere contains approximately 850 gigatons of carbon. By the way, 1 gigaton is equal to 1 billion tons. And we are already feeling the aftermath of that much carbon concentration above our heads, shown by the examples I presented earlier in this discussion. However, according to the National Snow and Ice Data Center, across the entire Arctic Circle, in the tundra and permafrost, sleeps about 1,400 gigatons of frozen carbon, primarily as methane. And although most greenhouse gas emissions are CO2 and will remain in the atmosphere for hundreds and even thousands of years, methane leads to global warming, or on ways that we cannot even imagine. Compared to CO2, the IPCC estimates that methane is 86 times a more potent and warming greenhouse gas. At present, Russian United States methane study at the International Arctic Research Center estimates the atmosphere contains 5 gigatons of methane. Therefore, imagine the gradual release of 1,000 gigatons more. 5 gigatons now, 1,000 more coming. The release of the Arctic trapped methane will lead to runaway global warming. No amount of human ingenuity and technology or prayer will be able to slow it or hold it. And that could start in as little as 10 years and as long as 16 years. That's how close we are to having the warming of the Arctic, ice-free, the heating of the bottom of the Arctic, which is shallow most places, and then the release of methane. The release of methane from Siberia, Canada, the boreal forest, is going to happen at such a fast rate that we will not be prepared for it. Arctic methane release is not a far-off scenario. It is happening at this moment. Seamen traversing the polar ocean now observe vast methane plumes bubbling from the Arctic Ocean floor. In response to the growing evidence of methane release, Jason Box, a renowned Arctic and Greenland scientist, tweeted, "If even a small fraction of Arctic seafloor carbon is released to the atmosphere, we're done." Methane has also been released into the atmosphere. However, it has not posed a warming threat. Global warming increases humidity as more land water evaporates. As the humidity increases, so does the amount of ice particles in the upper regions of the troposphere. Atmosphere ice reduces the oxidation of methane. Consequently, as global temperatures increase, the methane's warming potential also increases. Methane contained in the permafrost has two different sources. Methyl clathrate, and those are methane molecules trapped in cages of ice crystals. Not only are they found deep in the Arctic tundra, but also deep in the Arctic Ocean. Once warm, the ice cracks thereby release the trapped methane. The other source of methane is found in the frozen organic matter in the permafrost itself. It is made of a thick layer of soil from numerous dead plants and animals that have been frozen deep in the permafrost for thousands of years. And once this organic material warms, bacteria and other microbes further decompose this matter and release carbon dioxide and methane as waste into the atmosphere. And to better understand this process, Kevin Schaefer, a scientist at the NSIDC, offers an example. He says, "It's like taking a bag of frozen broccoli out of the freezer and putting it into the refrigerator. Once it thaws, it will eventually decay and break down. But moreover, the permafrost holds oxides of nitrogen, another greenhouse gas. And with the advance of global warming, there is now 1,400 gigatons of greenhouse gases awaiting as a time bomb to escape its captivity in the frozen Arctic landscape." Now, another source of methane in the northern climate are the what are called methanogens. These methane-released microbes are plentiful in the Arctic waters. Scientists still do not know the extent of the danger these organisms present. And while the water remains at a freezing temperature, they are unable to proliferate. They have been there for many millennia. However, as the ocean surface warms, there is fear that these will dramatically increase their bioactivity and start releasing methane. A summary of the methane threat compiled by retired Earth Sciences scientist Malcolm Light with the Arctic Methane Emergency Group includes the following recent events that are now accelerating. Methane emissions are quickening faster than CO2 and have increased 300% during the last 200 years. In some regions of the Arctic, permafrost melt has risen 400% during the past 50 years. Enormous amounts of methane have been belching across the entire northern hemisphere, particularly in the Eurasian Basin. Active methane zones in the Arctic are now descending down Greenland's eastern coast. This is largely the result of warmer waters in the Arctic Ocean's Gulf Stream. The Eastern Siberian Ice Shelf, a region of approximately 810,000 square miles, has been melting more rapidly, with methane release increasing by 9 million tons during a two-year period. It's also wise to remember that the methane threat is not limited to the Arctic and the northern tundra. The melting of Greenland and the Antarctic ice shelves will also release gigatons of methane held in deep reservoirs. And for many years, Natalie Shakahova at the University of Alaska's International Arctic Research Center and an expert on Siberia's tundra and permafrost has been warning of the tipping of this and is a ticking time bomb posed by sequestered methane ready to be released once a certain threshold of permafrost melting is passed. In a study published in December 2016 issue of Paleo World, we are reaching a potential apocalyptic event similar to the mass extinction that occurred during the last age 250 million years ago. At that time, 90% of all the Earth's land and aquatic species were decimated from the dramatic release of methane hydrates. The study warns, quote, "The end of Permian holds an important lesson for humanity regarding the issue it faces today with greenhouse gas emissions and global warming and climate change." Well, such an extinction event need not take long to reach its final conclusion. It could be sudden and unexpected, like a black swan episode. And Shakova has warned of the potential for a gigantic methane burp sitting and waiting discharge. A single 50-gigaton burp would be the equivalent to 2/3 of all CO2 emitted by humanity since 1850. And according to a study published by Arctic scientist Peter Wadhams in the prestigious journal Nature, a sudden 50-gigaton methane ejection is completely plausible and likely, and such an event could quickly change the climate for the worse overnight. The researchers also estimated there could be a $60 trillion price tag to the global economy due to drought and flooding and extreme weather and declining agricultural security and physical health if such a cataclysmic event were to occur. Although we have been focusing on positive feedback loops, which are undesirable, the warming tundra does introduce a negative feedback that may give some relief. As the permafrost melts and seasons warm, we might expect a burst of plant and green growth in the thawed tundra and its nutrient-rich soil. This would mean a larger release of oxygen, which is critical to slowing global warming. And more oxygen in the atmosphere will also increase the oxidation of tropospheric methane and reduce its global warming potential. Let us also examine the loss of forest and grasslands. Every major wildfire across forests and grasslands contributes to enormous release of CO2. In 2017 alone, hundreds of wildfires burned across the American West and north into Western Canada. In August and September of 2017, over 2 million acres were ablaze from over 100 separate fires, roughly the size of Rhode Island and Delaware combined. For the entire summer, approximately 8 million acres were lost, which is almost 3 million more acres than the average for the past 10 years. And although it's estimated that 84% of wildfires are started by people, the conditions for their severity and spread is now largely due to climate conditions, especially drought. This was only for the United States. That same year, the European heat wave, nicknamed Lucifer, set off wildfires in Italy, Portugal, and Romania. Emergency-level wildfires also plagued Siberia, large swaths of Brazil, Chile, New Zealand, and South Africa. And according to a joint study conducted by Australian and American researchers in 2017, catastrophic wildfires are expected to increase up to 50% in the future. And the western U.S. is particularly vulnerable. We're talking about Texas, California, Nevada, Colorado, South Dakota, Kansas, and New Mexico. Very severe droughts and winds and changing wet seasons as longer dry periods suck more moisture out of the trees and the ground cover vegetation. And more frequent electrical storms have long been predicted as a consequence of global warming, which puts western forests and grasslands in further jeopardy. And fires are also reaching the northern tundra regions, where natural fires have been unknown for thousands of years. A wildfire burned for over a week in western Greenland, to the shock of many. In 2014, fires in the northern tundra were ignited only 70 miles away from the Arctic Ocean. So as natural fires continue to move northward, soot and carbon fallout will continue to warm and melt existing ice sheets. Atmospheric scientists are unable to accurately calculate how much wildfires increase CO2 concentrations. As earlier computer model estimated, the California wildfires during an 8-day period in 2007 were equivalent to 25% of the average monthly emissions from all fossil fuel burned in the entire state of California. And more recent wildfires have been far more devastating and more frequent. The 1997 fires that swept across Indonesia were estimated to have released 2.5 gigatons of carbon, which was somewhere between 13 and 40% of all the world's carbon emissions that year. And hence, imagine what that did to the environment and to people's health, especially people in Indonesia. What is worse? With the planet warming and vegetation coverage becoming drier and more parched, a Kansas State University study predicted that CO2 released from wildfires will conservatively double in the future. And as noted earlier, as the weather warms, the migration northward of invasive insects, particularly beetles, is killing off forest. And this too is a feedback loop. Dying infested trees increase the likelihood of fires and thereby add more CO2 to the atmosphere, which in turn further heats the planet. This dire scenario is compounded by hotter weather and the loss of seasonal weather conditions that will make it more difficult for trees and shrubs to rebound after devastating wildfires. A final feedback mechanism at work with climate change and increasing wildfires is lightning strikes. For example, according to California's Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, there were 8,600 wildfires in 2017 alone. Aside from the massive loss of personal property and homes and buildings and even human life, over 1.1 million acres of land were lost to blazes. There was also reported a record number of lightning strikes that same year. And during a single 48-hour period, just 2 days, Northern California experienced 3,000 lightning strikes. And during another storm period over Southern California, an extraordinary 40,000 lightning strikes were reported. For many years, the rise in extreme storms, including electrical storms, has been predicted as a consequence of warming trends. In a 2014 study published by the journal Science, every 1 degree Celsius increase in the planet's average temperature will boost the frequency of lightning strikes by approximately 12%. So long periods of drought and below average rainfall and dying trees and shrubs and dry grasslands dying create perfect conditions to ignite forests and fields and neighborhoods as storms become more extreme and perhaps reoccurrent. I'm Gary Nall, and that brings us to the conclusion of today's program. And I will continue with our next on an upcoming Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much for listening. Have a nice day. Hey, what's up?
many of you cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me, sister, with brutality, sister. Talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister. Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh,
right, right on.
Judge us simply 'cause our hair is long. Oh, you know we've got to find. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
What's going on?
Right on. Right on.